Good afternoon, everybody. Welcome back to Robots and Red Tape. As always, I am your host, Nick Schutt. Happy to have my friend Paco Nathan with me here today. Paco, how are you, sir?
Wonderful. Thank you very much, Nick. I'm really excited. I appreciate getting in to talk with you here.
Absolutely, man. I really appreciate you hopping on. I know you're very busy, and I know you have a lot of demands on your time, and taking the time to do this means a lot to me. So
Looking
if you
forward.
don't mind, and today, just so everybody knows, today we're talking about identifying, real versus hype in AI, among other things. And for folks that don't know you yet, Paco, do you mind telling everybody a little bit about yourself, your background, and kind of how you got here?
Certainly. Let's see. Against all advice from like mentors, elders, whatever, I decided to go into a program, graduate study in artificial intelligence. That was about 42 years ago, and I had been in a program that was interdisciplinary. It was basically statistics, some machine learning, applied math, visualization, optimization, like operations research kind of stuff. And at the time, people are like, wow, none of that stuff's connected. Why are you even bothering? It was like, I think it might be important. And then I went into an AI program and we were doing early generative work. My grad advisor was Doug Lennett. He did Eurisco, some of the early examples of generative AI. And we really like stumbled across some concepts and issues and techniques and whatnot back then that I think are sort of being rediscovered now, but I think there's a lot that informs. And anyway, long story short, I was at NASA for a bit. I went to Bell Labs after grad school. Then, briefly for like 5 seconds, I got to work for John Hopfield. I basically begged and pleaded, and they took me on their team. But I don't know if you know, but John Hopfield got the Nobel Prize in deep learning. He shared that with Jeff Hinton. But reorgs hit, and so I went off and did network engineering, like you do. Let's see. And then I went over to Motorola. I was on a neural network hardware accelerator project back in the late '80s, and then that spun out to a company. Really interesting experience. I rode that all the way out to. That eventually became acquired part of a company that was, publicly traded. I was CTO of a publicly traded firm. Learned a lot of business experience through that, being on the board of a NASDAQ penny stock. And basically, for a while, nobody cared about data or machine learning. So I went up and did more network engineering and cybersecurity kinds of things. And then eventually that led me into leading data teams. One thing led to another, but I got these strange calls from Seattle and they wanted me to check out a thing. And eventually I got pointed to a website, hey, go sign up. And this is like mid 2006. So I became a guinea pig basically for early AWS. My teams were guinea pigs for services as they were being developed. And as I understand it, I was lucky to be brought in as a technical co-founder for a new startup right when AWS was launching. I went to the VCs and I went to the venture cap company behind us and said, hey, look, there's this new thing. It's called cloud computing. I think it's a good way that we don't burn our capital. Instead, we look at it as like OpEx expenses, pay as you go. And this was True Ventures. They were like, do it. We're all in. So we became the third company with 100% cloud architecture outside of Amazon. The first two were Hollywood Studios. So it was really fun to be on the ground floor of that. My team picked up this new little project because we had some problems with workflows. We picked up this new project called Hadoop, like in late 2006, and started. We actually ended up being part of the team that patched Hadoop so it would run efficiently on EC2. And then we ran, Amazon called up and said, hey, you've got the largest Hadoop instance in the cloud. We should talk. All that experience led me to get invited to critique. I don't know if you've ever heard of David Patterson at Berkeley, but he did something called RISC, people have heard of. Patterson invited me to critique a paper. It was called About the Clouds. It was like the first academic paper about cloud computing. And I did a guest lecture, and in the room, the grad students were basically the founding team of Databricks.
Oh, wow.
So that was fun. I got to know them, and I was working on Apache Spark spun out of its parent project was Mesos. So I was working on Mesos, the commercialization of it. And then after that, Databricks team invited me to join them back when we all fit in one room. So this is a long way of saying it's been an interesting career. I've kind of stumbled on some things that later worked out well. Did a lot of work with other open source projects, Jupyter, Spacy, etc. And now I'm at Sinzing, working in entity resolution. Because of a lot of work that I've done in natural language, that led me into graph technologies. Mm-hmm. And when you look at what entity resolution is doing in these large, mission critical use cases, there's a lot of related work, mm-hmm. closely adjacent work in graph technologies and then downstream AI applications.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. That's absolutely fascinating. So you're saying you started in AI over 40 years ago. So way before it was cool or applicable or like actually feasible to implement in any kind of large way, and just kind of stumbled your way through a career where you've, and I don't believe you've just stumbled your way through the career.
You don't
do all this kind of stuff unless you're like really, really good and smart. Don't be so humble, man.
My favorite story out of it is my lab partner back when I was in grad school. My lab partner, she would not stop talking about this one topic. Mm-hmm. And eventually I was just like, Janet, I promise I will study neural networks.
Yeah.
And so that was like in 1984. And mm-hmm. I did this real deep dive into it. And even at the time, the other people in AI are like, why are you messing around with that garbage? Mm-hmm. So it's been real fun to see how this all played out.
Yeah, absolutely. No, man, that's fantastic. And having like gone and you sat through all of these hype cycles, right? What's different about this AI wave as opposed to other ones? And what are some of the mistakes that are being repeated?
Well, I mean, on the one hand, there's a lot now that's very real, that's very applicable. We can do things that we just simply could not do, even like 3 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think that there's a lot to be discovered about where the applications are, where to really move the needle with this. So that's great. It's tangible. There's a lot to do. On the other hand, there's incredibly contrived hype. There's these narratives that are basically speculative fiction. And that's most of what gets the oxygen in the room. So what I see this time around is, like if you roll back to the mid 80s, there was the whole hype cycle about basically we're going to build supercomputers and somehow they're going to magically become sentient. Mm-hmm. If you just make them big enough. And then, funding realities, recession, all that hit, and all of that crashed. And then shortly thereafter, the world discovered this thing called Linux.
Mm-hmm.
And a few other things happened, internet. Mm-hmm. In that hype cycle, basically, we had a lot of ideas out of AI that are now resurfacing. Like, for instance, we talk about AI memory now. Well, there were Blackboard architectures in the mid 70s. If you look at like duty projects like Hearsay 2, agentic workflows off that. Mm-hmm. So we're rediscovering, there's a lot of things that were learned in that period, but we really came to the conclusion that the hard problems in AI, whether you're talking about planning, scheduling, summarization, search, all that, they're generally optimization problems. Mm-hmm. And machine learning is a subset of optimization. And most of the innovations in what we call AI now have come out of optimization labs. Mm-hmm. They're riding about 10 years ahead of, say, Mark Andreessen. Mm-hmm. So watch the optimization labs closely. And so the difference now is, compared to back then, we knew there were hard optimization problems. We did not have the hardware for it. Mm-hmm. There's just no way.
Yeah.
And that's part of, that's like the mini book I did with Dean Wampler for NVIDIA. Our premise was hardware is greater than software is greater than process. Because actually, when you look at it, hardware is evolving quicker than software is, and software is evolving quicker than process is.
Yeah.
And I think it's kind of the opposite of what a lot of people are taught coming out of school. But until you get the right hardware, in place, commoditized, you can't really do much other than just like draw some math equations on the whiteboard. Mm-hmm. So that was the problem in some of the earlier hype cycles was, hey, we have these great ideas, but, we'll need billions of dollars to even like get a fraction of the way. Now we've got the hardware to do it. We know how to do it. There's a lot out there we can, but the overall narratives are being really scrambled by people saying, you know, bizarre claims about superintelligence or AGI or whatever that are just specious and have so little to do with the use cases that we're seeing on the ground.
Absolutely. So those are maybe those things like an AGI or superintelligence could happen one day, but we don't have the hardware for it or the architecture for it now.
No. I mean, I think fundamentally it's a very different problem. And I imagine we might get into this later, but I can just jump to it is, I mean, we don't really have good definitions for intelligence. Intelligence that we understand is a social phenomenon. It's about what's recognized within group settings. And so it's really difficult to point to an individual just as a standalone individual operating on their own and going, that person's intelligent. I mean, it doesn't mean anything. There's no contrast. And pointing to a black box and saying that black box is intelligent is specious. So until we actually understand, and we have some good formal definitions for cognition, and we can talk about autopoiesis and all that. We do have some understanding of intelligence, but it's still a lot of it is just like phenomenological. We don't really have good. And so people coming out and saying, I've invented a box that's super intelligent is just complete bullshit.
No, it's cool. Bullshit. It's marketing. Yes. It's just marketing.
Yeah.
Really,
yeah, right? Yeah.
I mean, that's most of marketing is bullshit anyway. I know this, right? Like we are.
but the trouble now is like we've got literally trillions of dollars bet on marketing that is betting on speculative fiction. And you know, it's sort of like they're not even trying to capitalize their IP, they're trying to capitalize their narrative. That's what I see out of a lot of the big players in Silicon Valley right now regarding AI. And I think that that's a huge overhang. That is another big difference now versus other hype cycles, is just the stakes are absurd.
Absolutely. I can absolutely see that. And yeah, the stakes are absurd. There's a lot of money and a lot of energy invested in this. And so I agree that I think a lot of these companies seem to be building or trying to build what they are marketing that they can do right now, instead of actually trying to, solve problems, right? And like solving the real problems and correct, you know, a lot of the problems that we can solve now with AI at the moment, they're not like the sexy problems, right? These are a lot of them are, you know, I'm not going to say boring, but like they're things that people don't think about. They're things that people don't, that people don't like want to solve, and it gets harder to put a marketing message around them. Well, so I'm not sure if I'm right about that or not, but it's fascinating to me.
You look at the impact of the problem. Like, for instance, we work a lot of our use cases are in anti-fraud. I mean, if you look now, violent crime rates are dropping, but you're seeing this enormous increase in fraud rates. In the UK, more than 40% of all crime is fraud now. Wow. It's so much simpler. If you want to go do crime, you know, rather than like pulling a knife on somebody out in the street and hoping they have cash in their wallet, instead take your laptop and like steal somebody's grandmother's bank account. You can do it while you're sipping an espresso. Yeah. And so that's how like crime has changed. And I think that a lot of what we're seeing, you're right, it's maybe not the most sexy problem, but it's a big problem.
Oh, yeah.
Because there's $3 trillion a year in dark money flows. And this is powering, you know, mercenaries, weapons transfer, human trafficking, even illegal fishing. It's all kind of clustered. And if you can make a dent in that, I mean, we probably would not need to be paying nearly as much taxes if we get rid of the corruption due to like money laundering.
Yeah.
And that's reality. And so we can leverage AI technologies to go after those kind of complexities and kind of bring it back to human scale. But it's a human problem. It's not just like technology is going to solve all this.
Yeah, absolutely. And then, you know, like there are all those, and I'm blanking on the name of the kind of, the like pig farming attacks. I forget the name exactly, but like these whole things down in like Southeast Asia somewhere, where they're like running and they just have a whole building full of essentially slaves, or people that they're holding their will and using them to social engineer people into giving them money and stuff like that. And it's like, that's a huge problem, but that's not one we can, that's like solving that while it is super helpful is not like, I don't think that that's like, there's not like, I don't know, VCs probably won't throw as much money at that as they will
Right.
speculative AGI stuff, right?
Right, exactly. No, let's go have lunch. We'll talk about AGI. Forget this other stuff that's like costing lives.
Right, and hurting people. Yeah, no, that's not what we're trying to do. Of course not. No, it's crazy though. But
We're
that's a
saving the world.
yeah, that's a societal issue, Paco. That's a different thing. Yeah, man. So, but yeah, back on like on some like, as I know you were heavily involved in Databricks very early on. I know you helped build that community. Yeah, as people are looking at what lessons from that, from the Spark era should today's generative AI builders relearn about scale and governance as well?
Yeah, awesome, awesome question. And I will give credit. I mean, Andy Konwinski was co-founder along with Matei Zaharia. They were co-founders of Databricks. Andy had led the Spark camps that were popular. He'd led those at Berkeley. And so when I joined, I took over Spark Camp and also some of those other efforts. But Andy really built that out. And then after I left the company, it was interesting because one of our customers we were working with, Danny Lee, was at Microsoft. He came in and Andy took over my job for a bit, and then Jules Demji also, and then Denny Lee is now in that role. He had been one of our customers, but now he leads DevRel. So I'll give a shout out to them because they've really built this out so much. And I think, like, to answer your question there, when you really look at what Databricks was doing early, they had experience definitely, giving credit to like people like Lester Mackey, McKay, I'm pronouncing his name wrong. He'd been on the Netflix Prize and he'd seen what a disaster it was to try to use Hadoop for real machine learning in, when you have big problems. He'd seen that as a disaster and he kept complaining about it. And McKay and Andy were sitting across from him at Berkeley and they're like, oh, I think we can fix that. But they were looking at real problems. They'd been working at companies like Cloudera and Google and whatnot, and they'd seen why, even though Hadoop was being kind of pushed as this narrative, it was clunky. The project governance was really bad. Workflows would fail all the time, and I think there are really two things that happened. One was Matei went to ground and did research, really rolling it back to like Alonzo Church and a lot of the early theoretical work in computer science, like lambda calculus, map and reduce are two of the combinators out of lambda calculus. Matei went back and said, well, we can use others too. And they looked at it. They looked at the why do big data distributed big data jobs, why do they fail? It's usually because you get hammered during the aggregation phase. And that's where you've basically got a weak link in the chain and something fails and it all goes down. So Matei said, well, why don't we go back to the math and we can look at doing, we can adjust the width of an aggregation and we can learn from that. And we don't have to do everything so fixed the way that Hadoop was, and it'll be much more robust. It won't be so brittle. And we'll apply a lot of network engineering and really make commodity clusters like Zoom for this stuff. So it was really this matter of going back to the math, borrowing a lot of difficult math, also abstract algebra coming out of functional programming, where you're looking at applicative systems and closures. I know I'm throwing out a bunch of terms, but basically what I'm saying is these people had seen a real problem in industry and they went back to ground and did their homework and really like rolling back to like the 19, 30s and 40s, they really did foundational work and came out with something that was robust and could be applied generally. And they did all this before they ever said a word about we're the world's leading team in applicative systems. So they did all that foundational work. And then they also looked at the dumpster fire that was Hadoop project governance. And they're like, hey, no, let's actually have something equitable. Let's work with partners. Let's build an ecosystem and let's have some decent governance where people can actually make something happen. And as a result, the thing was, we were actually surprised. It wasn't our PR that was driving. It was like, we would find out how somebody was using Spark and we're like, wow, that's incredible. Let's tell other people about it. As opposed to like tail wagging the dog of like issuing press releases. Here's our product. Here's our solution. We need to find we need to find demand for it,
right?
Instead of the other way around. So I think that that would be my advice. Was I think that early Databricks probably had enough ideas for maybe 10 unicorn startups, but they really they kept it well orchestrated, well organized, and just always like think about the use case, how to be smart. Yeah.
Absolutely, and I mean I think that's I think that's antithetical for how most of these products are generally developed, right? Is they're usually, to your point, I built this cool thing, let's go find somebody that'll buy it now, as opposed to
right.
Yeah, building and engaging with your users and actually understanding and seeing how it's being used, and then, you know, and actually, but also they, you know, I also love what you said, that they really, before they started marketing themselves as like the experts in the world, people, they actually did the thing first. Oh, which is cool, right? It's
they
also not,
and they made sure it run at scale.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, a lot of technical folks. I don't know if it's just technical folks. I think a lot of people do that, right? They want to talk about how amazing they are before they do anything amazing.
It is part of the human condition, unfortunately. Mm-hmm. Yeah,
absolutely. And so as you're looking at these new these new developments, are there like technical smell tests that you apply before to like distinguish like real innovation from like the marketing stuff we've been talking about?
Yeah, I mean, a lot of that comes back to linguistics. I was listening to a podcast, it was called Dystopia Now, and there was a linguist on there who's really studied, he's focused a lot on like social media linguistics, and he was making a point. There are some odd philosophical bents that have emerged in Silicon Valley, and one of those is where you basically take like software engineering, sort of think of like, you know, a scrum meeting, stand-up meeting, and the kind of language you would use to describe how you're handling your Jira tickets, that is filtered out into like common everyday social discourse in Silicon Valley. And you see certain words, like I use the word adjacent. I mean, it's basically taking technology concepts and then talking about them in real life. Mm-hmm. There was a, I don't know if you ever saw, pardon me, but I'm going to jump back to like Star Trek, The Next Generation. There was an episode, there's like two warring planets. Mm-hmm. These aliens, they're saying things, the universal translators can't figure out what they're saying. Eventually, Picard picks up on the fact that what they're saying, they're speaking entirely in prepositional phrases that have historical impact. So Picard jumps up and he's like, Dababa at Gamora. Mm-hmm. And the aliens suddenly can understand him, and they did the alien equivalent of like, my dude, bring it in. Mm-hmm. And that's what we see. That's my smell test, is like when people are out there talking about architecture, they can only describe technology if they're referencing, different platforms, as if they were the nouns and verbs in the sentence. Mm-hmm. When I hear that kind of stuff, I know that somebody has not even bothered to consider the use cases. They don't understand the trade-offs. They don't understand the underlying math. And so that's usually when I start to back off.
Absolutely. So it's fascinating. So when they use other people as the other companies as the way to describe what their product does, then that's like a huge red flag.
I think it's a red flag. I remember, I mean, the only time I've ever been a founder taking VC funding, I've been on the other side of the table as an equity partner, but the only time I've ever taken VC funding personally, 2006. And I remember the VCs at the time when we were going for our second round, they wanted everybody to either be a clone of Flickr or YouTube at the time. Mm-hmm. Like you tried to have a conversation about funding and they're like, well, how are you an embellishment on Flickr? And we're like, we're not Flickr.
Yeah.
But I think that that's kind of perpetuated. It's like there's a lot of that language and that kind of thinking. And the rhetoric, the rhetorical posture really tells you what's going on inside their heads.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, I completely agree with it. Not just with people, but with companies, and you see how they market and how they talk about themselves, how you talk about yourself and how you like, that tells me a lot about you as a person, right? How do you communicate with the world? And you can start trying to understand maybe how they think, or not necessarily, not maybe not how they think, but how they want you to perceive them, which is also far more important, or is also very, very important. And I side note, the guy you mentioned that in this podcast that is a social media language expert, man, what a horrible thing to be an expert in. I can't imagine.
No, I mean that's what they're saying is like we really picked the wrong trajectory when we were in grad school, and now we have to read and listen to the most horrible stuff for like hours at a time just so you don't have to. We can make it. Yeah, no, it's kind of funny. I'll give you a link to that. I will say that on the flip side, what I do recognize as good is like I live in this world where, there are libraries, there's code, there's data. You can run it, you can get validation on it. And even for fairly complex things, you can still run it and get that validation. I have the luxury of living in that world, and so that's really where I try to stay grounded is like, hey, can I get my hands on it? Can I run it? Can I demonstrate that it actually passes the evaluations that are claimed? And I mean, when I see that, that's real, that's tangible. That's something that can be worked into a use case.
Absolutely. Just that for a layperson that's not in this world as much, any tips for them?
I mean, I think that I would say that there's just so much noise about AI as being a handful of services that are basically chatbots that can do all kinds of crazy stuff, whether you're like doing diffusion to generate images or write reports or whatever. That's not AI. And we can talk more about definitions there, but if you want to be using the underlying tooling, it's not that hard. It's not that expensive. I was at the MLOps community event, AI Agent Builders World Tour, and there was a lightning talk. There was a young woman who said that she very deliberately had just carved off a month, and she had tried all kinds of different products and packages, just like using free tiers, spent a month just learning about all this by doing it. And it wasn't that hard. She didn't really have to get help. There's a lot that's available out there. At the end of it, I asked her, how much did you spend on this? She's like, $100.
That's
I
awesome.
mean, it's out there. If you want to get your hands on and learn how to use this, go out and use DSPy, go out and use BAML, go out and use Comet, Arize, et cetera. There's a lot of stuff, and there's great tutorials. Get your hands dirty and get your own validation and grounding and like what works, what doesn't work. Like there might be something that everybody's talking about, and you find out, well, actually, that process takes about 3 hours to run on my laptop. So I'm not going to be doing a whole lot of iteration cycles on it. And the dirty little secret is that if you take, I will paraphrase Vaibhav Gupta from BAML, but like the problem with using LLMs is if you use them too much, like you have too many steps that are all based on some kind of LLM interaction, the thing that kills you is going to be latency. And that the cost and latency are the dirty little secrets. And people can make really sophisticated, complex architectures and project in the future we'll be able to do this. But the fact is, if you've got a 100 millisecond SLA and you're putting together an architecture that has, a 5 minute SLA, it's not going to work.
Absolutely. No, and I it's something that I always tell people, and I always remind them, like, dude, you got to think about it from the user perspective, right? Like, how are they going to use it, and what's that experience going to be like? Because I know it, and I mean, especially in today's day and age, like if I open Waze to drive somewhere and it's taking too long to load, I will just quit Waze and open Google Maps instead, and it'll load faster, right? But yeah, it doesn't have as awesome, it doesn't have as many features, but even though they're owned by the same
Awesomeness.
company, of course, but I like the user experience is everything, I think. And I think that some technical people can get lost in that.
Well, I mean, it's a really important point. I think, this is something you should underscore. We were talking about this earlier too. UX really has become a bottleneck for AI adoption. If you think that AI is just, I have a service on a chatbot and there's some magic system behind it and I interact there, if that's all you're doing, I could see that maybe this argument doesn't really come out. But if you're trying to apply more of the AI ops into real world problems, what you run into really quickly is like, yeah, we can you know, fire up clusters and do amazing work, but how do we get that in front of a person where teams of people can really take action on it? And it's those UX factor, it's the UI design. I talk about like design for human scale. Unless you can really crack that, you can't bring in these other components from the machines. Mm-hmm. So it's interesting to me because it's kind of a two-way street. UX is really a lot of the bottleneck right now for AI adoption. On the other hand, a lot of AI adoption is really about how can we augment UX in a smart way? So I think people need to pay more attention to that because that's going to be the stumbling block if we are actually in any kind of a hype cycle right now.
Absolutely. And when you leave the slide deck and open the code, right? What is production ready AI actually look like?
Yeah. So, you know, there, I think it's important to mention that there's quite a toolbox. People talk about LLMs. The reality is, I mean, language models have been around for a long time. They're always been heavy on the model, light on the language. LLMs were, you know, basically this generation of it started coming out in late 2017-ish. The idea of having transformers with attention heads. But when you look at the services, there's a lot more than that going on. I mean, a lot of the fine tuning and training is based on reinforcement learning and other technologies. There's a lot of graph work that goes in. Most of the big services are actually ensembles of many different models, but a lot of different parts. Embedding models are different from the language models. There's just many, many, many different parts. And so to get back to your question there, what's really going on is to understand what are the design patterns for the use cases that you need and how can the different components really come into it? Not just saying, I'm going to take a hard problem and throw all my data in an LLM and expect magic to happen. Instead, really dig in, understand the design patterns. I think a lot of what people have been talking about are essentially information retrieval patterns. And so much of like RAG, question answer bots, all that comes out of this history of recommender systems and search engines. There was semantic search, very sophisticated, much like we see in contemporary graph RAG. There was very sophisticated search and recommendations going on a decade ago. The only thing that's really different about that, other than like maybe some of the accuracy of components, the real difference is now after you get all the recommended results, you can summarize them into like a paragraph using the LLM. But upstream of the LLM, putting all the pieces together, getting the content ready to provide into the context window, that plumbing has been there for a while and it's been used.
Yeah.
And so I think that when you understand this design pattern of information retrieval, there's quite a backlog of what you can leverage out of search and RecSys. And a lot of and that's actually the heavy lifting for a lot of these applications. When you look at agents, you know, people are talking about essentially executing some kind of task. There's also a lot of backlog of that, whether you're talking about BPA or just like rolling back to Blackboard architectures from the 70s. Reinforcement learning, that's been around since like, I mean, realistically, it's optimal control theory. It's been around since the 50s. So understand what you're doing, what you need to accomplish, where are the components, and don't just accept that there's some magic black box that's going to solve it all.
Yeah, you can't just sprinkle some AI on it. It's not magic. Like a lot of people think you just sprinkle some AI on it and then it's like problems are solved and everything. And not even like absolutely not. And so do you have an AI success story that like, you know, somebody that's quietly succeeding because of like the boring, I'm not gonna say boring, but just like it solved a boring problem, whether it's, rather than just like model magic.
Yeah, I think that a lot of people think the world started in 2022, late 2022, but really 2023 when, you know, like OpenAI was introducing ChatGPT and all that. It didn't. I mean, I think that one of my favorite examples would be rolling back to early days of COVID pandemic. There's a company called Primer out of San Francisco as an advisor, and they had been doing work for DoD and others using different kinds of summarization. They've been experimenting with generative approaches. And when the pandemic hit, they recognized that there was, you know, a national emergency, that really a lot of the pain point was we have these frontline medical people And I mean, they're being worked 24/7. They don't have time to catch up on the literature that's coming out that might actually, save lives. They're just trying to execute, and they're exhausted. So what they said was like, let's ingest every paper that's been published in the last 24 hours or previous about COVID. And also, let's collect a lot of the disinformation that like these frontline healthcare workers are going to be confronted with and summarize it. So they use generative AI approaches to summarize that and make that free for all healthcare providers.
Amazing.
And I thought that was an amazing service because it really fit that again, bringing a complex problem back to human scale, it really fit the design problem of like these people are exhausted, they're working 18-hour shifts, they need to understand what they need to know, but they can't spend hours a day reading research papers. They need it like now. And so I think that was kind of you could put it into the category of maybe boring or not sexy applications, but it was really interesting use of summarization early on. I see that a lot in anti-fraud now, where like one of the biggest problems we have is like you have different investigator teams. Somebody under, one team might understand border crossings, another one understands telecom, and they may not even know what they're working on until like prosecutors are in a courtroom, right? It's like they don't see all the pieces, but they have to do a lot of handoffs between the teams. And frankly, it's a great job if it weren't for the paperwork. They spend an hour or two a day writing reports just to be able to do handoffs. It's like, duh, we can be using this technology now to help make those handoffs not just simpler and quicker, but actually better. And I mean, that sounds boring, but that is a big problem when you're addressing, again, going back to like money laundering, human trafficking, et cetera.
So no, and huge, huge, like it's a huge thing, right? As you as like end of 2023, I made the decision to like I wanted to get as many tasks off my plate as I could that like that were not that were that other people could do, right? I want to spend my time doing the things I'm best at, right? Which is forward-facing stuff, other things. I don't know, it just depends on the day. Like I could be running payroll, but that I shouldn't be, right? And so it's the same
I
thing.
definitely should not.
It's like all kinds of math, Paco, but none of that, right? But like, I like, but like with payroll, one time I made a mistake and I was actually accidentally paying a different state taxes. I was paying the wrong state and I had to, come out of pocket for 10 grand and it was a whole thing and whatever. It is what it is, right? But that's a problem that I created for myself, right? And like, I also, when I think about these folks that are incredibly talented, like whether they're, tracking fraud, tracking, border crossings, tracking, human trafficking, human traffickers, right? Like I don't want them writing reports. I want them doing the work that they should be doing, right? Which is tracking these people down and trying to get them out of society in some way, as opposed to writing reports to send to another team so that they can do a different piece than when all the notes and everything is already going to be there, right?
It should already be there.
Now, out of curiosity, do you think that like should there be, as we do things like this, are there ways that you think you should, do you think you should force like them to edit these things and review them as part of the workflow to ensure that they don't become over-reliant on the tool and just like not
Oh,
review what
absolutely.
they do?
No, absolutely. I mean, anything that's generated is going to be draft stage. Frankly, I do a lot of writing and I do use these tools. I mostly use them when I'm really kind of stuck on trying to phrase something. I'll throw it in to a server, a chat bot, and summarize this for me. And I'm usually so appalled by how terrible the results are that like compels me to go out and write something better. So I do think that like, the tools definitely have their failings and they need to be basically considered as like a rough draft stage.
Yeah, absolutely. I like to use them to like help name my episode titles for the for because I like using alliteration, right? And it's just like give me some options with alliteration involved, right? Hence robots and red tape, right? Like it's it's I feel like it's
It's
back to marketing. I feel like it's stickier when there's alliteration involved, right?
yeah,
And
that's
so
awesome.
yeah, so like things like that, great use for it. And I also like I use it for I don't really like Google things anymore. Like I because like that experience, I don't know, I feel like the internet like over the last 20 years, from like 2005 to now has really been so much more commercialized in so many other ways. And it's not as like pure as it used to be. It's not as easy to find like simple answers without somebody trying to sell you something. And I think that right now AI is great for that. I do worry about how long it's going to be before you start seeing sponsored answers in like ChatGPT or like in any of these other places. But, you know, I assume that's going to happen.
It's already there. I mean, I will definitely reference Andrea Volpini and Beatrice Goomba at WordLift. They did one of the best AI talks I've seen in a long time. They did at KnowledgeGraph Conference in May. And it was basically saying, from an advertiser perspective, your next client is an agent. Mm-hmm. And how can you do that? How can you meet them in the middle? What can you do on behalf of your clients to really make them meet in the middle? How can you be developing an ontology for their specific content and then making this consumable by essentially machine understanding? It's already out there where, you know, a lot of these services are starting to pull a lot of market share from Google. Mm-hmm. I think that's been top of mind. SEO really is going to change completely all notions of that. But at the end of the day, I mean, I think that people who are publishing content, there's a way forward. It's not all that different because it still is based on a lot of the search and recommendation things that we've been working with for years.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. How do you feel, how do you think like open source models versus like closed weight APIs will evolve?
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, people talk about open source LLMs. Most of it is not open source. It's like maybe open weights. There's some that's open source. I do think, though, if you go back to like the earlier, we were talking about design patterns and components. A lot of the components are being used are all based off open source. When you talk about like what's going on with the reinforcement that's used, or what's going on with maybe embedding models, or on and on and on. There's the different parts. Generally, the components are, you can find great open source for that. So I think that having really heavily capitalized a handful of companies, and they've got these great services, they're promising the world, that's kind of a moment in time. It feels very much like a Hadoop moment when there were like a few MPP vendors who were promising the world and nobody even knows about them now. Mm-hmm. I think Teradata might have like, you know, acquired the remains of some of them, but otherwise, I think we're at a similar moment now. There's a lot more that can be done with AI, but we really need to be careful about the definitions and understand the use cases. It's not going to be a matter of just like a handful of heavily capitalized players. So I think that we'll see a lot more of essentially unbundling. And that's actually kind of the theme of the classes that I've been doing lately, is like how to take these complex things and unbundle them, understand each of the components, what's the state of the art in open source that you could be using. Uh-huh. And it's amazing when people, you know, when the light bulb goes off, it's like, oh, wait, I can do that too. Mm-hmm. But I really do need to understand all the steps in the workflow. And oh, by the way, that was actually really helpful to understand the steps.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely, man. No, and you know, for CIOs out here, like feeling pressured to have an AI strategy, but can't define a measurable ROI. How do you approach that conversation? And you know, what guidance do you give them?
Yeah, I mean, this was something that came out of the AI conferences really a couple of years ago. The short one-liner answer to that is like, focus on tasks that are well-known that your people are doing all day, every day. Mm-hmm. And focus on how these can be augmented and not delegated. I mean, I think a lot of what people call automation is really just delegation, and you sort of live with the results. True automation is actually something that's very, very rare. Mm-hmm. I will make that point. But if you can understand what is it that your people are struggling with and doing as part of your core business model, mm-hmm. where can you find those collaborations, those workflows? Yeah. Whether it's closing an enterprise sale deal or like having contingencies for procurement or whatever, find out those pain points in your company, find out the stuff that your people know how to do all day, every day, and then find out, again, what are the design patterns to augment that? So that you really have, I mean, going back to my definition for AI, you have teams of people and machines collaborating, and they're producing capabilities that are beyond what any individual could do. Mm-hmm. So find out where is it that the machines and people can be collaborating, with emphasis on your people, what they do now is the thing you're trying to amplify.
Absolutely. What do you have some examples of true automation? You said it was very rare.
Yeah, no, I do. I mean, if you think about it, I mean, like autopilots that emerged again mid-century, they're really good for aircraft, but you don't want to like do a takeoff or landing on autopilot. In fact, I don't think that's actually legal. And there might be automated drones, but there's still people like managing. So, I mean, I think that automation is kind of a charade in some ways. You look at Waymo cars. I mean, I understand that there's like 1.5 observers for every car that's on the road. There would be less people involved if you actually had a driver. But yet we call them automated cars, but not really. I mean, my example of automation, I mean, like I used to have an E300, so a Mercedes automatic transmission is just outstanding. I mean, to beat that with a manual shift, you have to be a factory trained race driver. But you know, somebody still needs to like kick it into park or reverse, right? So automation is kind of full automation is very, very rare.
Absolutely. No, of course it is. I was just curious, and then because of its rarity, right? And I think it like it's super interesting. I don't really know a whole lot of things that are completely automated right now.
And I mean, what we want to do in business is not to automate all of it. We do want to have smart people getting in and like pulling the levers and knobs. That's how we create value. And I thinking that you're just going to fire up a machine and it's going to create all the value for you. There's a lot of conceits baked into that. So I think you do want something where, again, you can unbundle, you can bring your people in at the right place, you can bring in your intellectual property, you can have your moat.
Absolutely. And then what if you want to like build a required course for business leaders called AI Reality 101, what are like the top three like labs or exercises that you would walk everybody through to help give them a like a base understanding?
Yeah, no, I mean, I would definitely put legal like front and center, not because we're going to get sued, but because of understanding ethics and understanding contractually what are we doing, the interactions. I would also put, HR front and center in that too, because they should actually be like coaching people and developing the people assets. So I think that for that kind of policy, you need to be focusing on how can we amplify teams? And yes, we have machines as parts of the teams. And frankly, I would have a few like a canon, make sure that the stakeholders in this have definitely read Seeing Like a State and Open Society and Its Enemies, and also definitely A Grammar of Motives, and probably Human Scale 1/2/3. I mean, if you've got those four books under belt, you can have a good discussion about the problems we're encountering in AI and how can we really make this work for our teams. If you don't understand the things that are being discussed in those four, not that they're sacred, but if you don't understand really more contemporary views of rhetoric, even bleeding into like autopoietic theory. And I know these are a bunch of two-bit words, but if you don't understand the human parts of it that come back to understanding culture and design, you're not going to be amplifying teams of people. You're not going to lead them to do something better. So that's where I would probably focus on getting away from a lot of the, there's a lot of current problems in HR because so many HR teams are sort of trying to use AI to like contend with this like enormous flood of resumes that were generated by AI. It's a spy versus spy game. Instead, getting back to ground on coaching teams of people and machines.
Absolutely. And what is your definition of intelligence? How do you define
Yeah,
it? You've done a, you've been in
no.
this for a long time, Paco. How do you
I've
define
been grappling with this for a long time. And I don't have a good definition for it. I mean, again, it's something that can be recognized in a social context.
So it's like it's what is it the that senator said about porn? I don't know how to define it, but I know it when I see
Yeah, exactly. I think
it.
that's probably our best working definition. But I mean, I do think that you can see that. I mean, certainly there are measures. You can see that a team is getting their stuff done more correctly, more efficiently. People are happier. They're working on the team. They're growing. They're really thriving. And the company is seeing the bottom line. You can see that when it happens. True stuff rings true. And I think that that's not something that's pushed on the people to demonstrate. That's something that's the onus is on the leadership. It's like, if you're a leader and you can't recognize that your team is acting better or worse, I'm not sure you're a leader.
Yeah. Well, I mean, there's a lot of, well, I also think that like there's a lot of bad leaders out there. Like true good leadership is hard to find. I also think that people generally rise to their level of incompetence, right? You know, keep getting promoted as long as you're doing well, and then you hit a spot where you can't get promoted because you're not doing, you're not, you can't move to that next level, and or maybe you're not thriving in that job, right? You know, I think about it like a lot in military terms, right? Like you can have like there are commanders that are good with like a, you know, a squad, you know, there's commanders that are good like managing 1,000 people, 5,000, you know, but like that you hit a level where you just like you can't, you know, you can't continue to move up.
Absolutely, you promote them wrong. That is something I've seen in the tech industry where people were really good individual contributors. They were outstanding software engineers. They'd really done the company, you know, justice on that. And so they're like, great, let's promote them into management. And they have no people skills and, you know, they get washed out 6 months later. I've seen that too many times.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, and as I think that there's like there's very different kinds of intelligence, right? There's folks that like, yeah, I'm not technically brilliant myself, like you are clearly, Paco, but I you know, I'm good at other things. I'm good at the people, I'm good at leadership, I'm good at building systems, I'm good at building relationships, and that is as valuable to a successful business as what you do, right? And I think that you have to build like you have to build out a solid organization with great people and with a great culture. And I think that's like a true that's true leadership and not
You
micro.
know, actually, something you mentioned there really kind of comes back full circle. Had a great conversation with a good friend, Mike Dillinger. He led a lot of the graph work at eBay, which is very central to what they do. And then for 7 years, he led a lot of the graph work at LinkedIn, which, of course, their business graph, that's their moneymaker. And, you know, Mike and I were talking about like the hard problems that he'd encountered at LinkedIn. And what it comes back to is like when people are talking about these kind of technologies, everybody looks at the facts. They don't look at the relations. You know, it's like data warehouse theory like tells people you must have facts. The relations are just, oh, that's baked into your schema. Don't worry about it. You're not really gonna manipulate that. But when we're actually working with these AI problems and we're leveraging graphs, what we find is the curation that you do on the relationships is orders of magnitude more important than what's going into the nodes, the entities. It's actually the relationships. We work in entity resolution and sensing, but really understanding the relationships among those entities, that's the gold. It's like if you've got five different data sets and one's in Arabic and the other's in Russian and another's in Italian, you're trying to, you know, find the footprint for entities, that's great. We can consolidate, we can show that Abbasine Badshah is showing up in five different places. But understanding who he's probably working with, that's your best lead if you're doing an investigation. So it's the relationships are actually so much more important. And we see this now in AI applications. Certainly we see it in terms of leadership working with people. It's the relationships that are important. I just wanted to bring that full circle because it's something that gets swept under the rug so much in technical discussions.
Yeah, I just I just actually spoke with a young woman from South Korea this morning, who she I'd met her I was on a panel at DC Startup Week a couple weeks ago, talking
Oh,
about
cool.
this and doing business here in this country. And I spoke with her, and she was like trying asking me like, how do you like do business in the United States, and how does that actually work? Because in her words, she said Korea like the only real way to sell your company is IPO. Like you just like that's it. Like, and I'm like, well, you know, here it's like it's all relationships, right? That's how I see it. Like everything is relationships. It's all about who you know, but more importantly, it's about who knows you and who's gonna think of you and walk things to you, right? It's like it's all relationships. Everything is a relationship. It's all about how can you. You know, like I've, you know, cold sales, like I've done cold sales and it's fine. Like it's just like it's the level of effort associated with it is so much higher than just saying, hey, call my guy, right? And so like a lot of what most of what I do, and I joke with people all the time, like I feel like most of what I do is just be professionally charismatic. Like that's kind of it.
Perfect. Perfect.
I don't know what else to
I'll drink
say.
to
Like,
that. Yeah, no, you're good. You're good.
yeah.
That's good. Well, I mean, you know, that's one thing that really struck me about sensing too is that I mean we're just like this small piece really in the large architecture for a lot of mission critical applications, but we're an SDK and we just do that one product. We don't do any professional services. Our prices are published. Our customer support is free. It's run by engineering. We do all these things because when we're working for defense, intelligence, law enforcement, we have to be really above board. I mean, there's all these reasons why we have to be accountable. And for security reasons, audits, clearances, et cetera, if we just make that distinction that, like, you know, we're not going to be trying to sell a product and services at the same time. Instead, we partner far and wide. We partner with everybody. And it's just such a better business model to have all these partnerships and really be building that, as opposed to saying, hey, we're this monolith and we do everything, which of course is never true. So I do like how, you know, this company really has so much focus on relationships, and it's kind of a superpower, because relationships with data providers, for instance, when you have a real critical problem, knowing where to get the right data sources, that's the difference between mission success and mission failure.
Absolutely, right? Because AI is an extension of your data infrastructure and is only as good
as
you get into it, right? And so, like, if your data is garbage, it's gonna, anything you do with it's gonna be garbage.
And you know, realistically, any kind of a regulated environment, you're almost certainly buying some data from different sources for compliance reasons. That's just kind of the superpower of this whole ecosystem where we're at. So I see this through line from, like, relationships with data providers, what you can get there. And a lot of it is really, it's counterintuitive. It's like, I talked to somebody recently where, you know, there's this problem of, like, people applying for jobs, but they're fake identities. And how can you flesh that out? Like, okay, so imagine people applying for IT jobs. Somebody says, I have 10 years in IT. Look them up and find out if they've been on a password breach. Because if they haven't been on a password breach in the past 10 years, yeah, no, they're not working in AI, or they're not working in tech. And so just simple things like that, data exhaust can be make it or break it. It's really kind of counterintuitive. But, like, there's this through line from, like, all these data providers and your data and what you're doing with your use cases, and then entity resolution going into graphs, graphs going into the context for context engineering for AI applications, and then a feedback loop to optimize on the context engineering. So, you know, it's kind of like an OODA loop on that side, but it's this through line that we see over and over again. And again, we're just kind of this one piece, the entity resolution part of it, but we do see this whole pattern being replicated over and over.
Yeah. And, like, people, like, applying for jobs and, like, screening them and everything. That's a whole thing. I've been hiring people for a long time, for myself and for others. And, you know, as you look at, how do you verify folks, and how do you actually know whether or not their skills are real? You know, like, part of it's going to be rubber meets the road, right? Part of it's going to be that, but, like, you know, my approach to all of it is, frankly, as I look at, I don't hire skill sets, I hire people, right?
Right.
I'm not evaluating their skill set as much as I'm evaluating the person. And so, you know, but, like, you do that enough, you're going to make mistakes. There's going to be missteps. There's going to be things, right? And every time I have hired somebody because of their skill set and not because of who they are, they've just been a pain in the ass. Every single time. I have stories. You know, I can't tell them all but, like, I have some stories.
I mean, mostly when I'm interviewing people in technical roles, I mean, it's the conversation. A 20-minute conversation, I can figure out most of what I would learn by, like, 8 hours worth of testing.
I'm not a fan of like, technical tests and things like that. I think that, especially in today's day and age, it's too easy to cheat on those. Way too easy. And so, like, I don't put your trust in that. You have to know how to get them to talk about things that are important, and how they talk about it is a lot more important than what they say, largely, in my experience. And then it's also figuring out whether or not they're, like, they're inquisitive and they love what they do, and they have
the curiosity. The curiosity will drive them over the goal line.
Absolutely, man. And so, you know, from drawing on your time at, like, NASA and Bell, where, you know, it was like human and machines shared control loops, like, what did those early collaborations teach us about real world human machine teaming?
Yeah, you know, excellent. The project I was on at NASA, this was at NASA Ames, again, back in the mid 80s. I was on an AI project back then. I was in flight guidance and navigation branch. So we were the people who trained the shuttle pilots. For instance, there was, like, a three-story elevator cab that the simulators that the actual shuttle pilots trained in. So if you screwed up, you drop three stories in a second. And stuff like that. It's really crazy seeing all the weird gadgetry around flight guidance. But there's a lot of military applications too, because if you're in an area of operations, you get this congestion, a lot of different type of aircraft having to come through, some of them perhaps damaged. You know, air traffic control becomes a nightmare. Mm-hmm. So what we were working on was, you typically think of like air traffic where you're looking at distance-based decision-making. Like I want these to be, you know, so many hundreds of meters apart, these mm-hmm. aircraft. But in reality, you kind of have to shift the domain conceptually and think about time-based. Like if a 737 goes through on a runway, it'll create a vortex. And so you get clear air turbulence. You basically get this like sideways tornado. And if you try to land a Cessna, even within the regulated distance, if you don't give it enough time, the Cessna will flip on the runway. And so that was a problem that, you know, used to happen way back when. We were looking at ways to have teams of air traffic controllers and pilots and, you know, all the people in the mix understanding not just the distance based, which is what the FAA regulations are or military regulations are, but also time based, which is practically speaking how you're going to avoid flipping over that smaller aircraft that has to follow. And you can imagine in a military situation, this could be exacerbated much, much more complicated there. So we were using AI to augment these teams, but again, it's not like we're going to make that decision. We're not going to land that aircraft for you, but we are going to show you when you're in a danger zone.
Yeah.
When you might not be able to see it yourself. Mm-hmm. And we can put a lot of computational power behind that and do really smart things. But again, it's about telling these teams, hey, here's something you need to notice. It's a design problem. Mm-hmm. And so I really learned from that. The irony that I was mentioning was like, you know, just a matter of years after I was on that project at NASA, NASA contracted a popular science fiction author, Werner Vinge. And if you've ever read like Neuromancer or The Matrix, a lot of this stuff is kind of based off a story he did a long time ago, True Name. So they hired Vinge because they're like, hey, the Terminator movie, that was awesome. Can you basically deconstruct this and like research if there's any way this might become possible and show citations? So he wrote this paper called the Coming Technology Singularity. And Vinge really, he showed like, well, if you want to be a science fiction author, here's like five scenarios of where machines take over. But realistically, a lot of this stuff is just BS. And the thing that really matters is more intelligence augmentation, having teams augmented with machines, again, collaborating together. And so that was a lot of my takeaway from NASA. And that was also what they confirmed in their singularity report. Unfortunately, there's like Silicon Valley tech billionaires who read that report and completely misinterpreted. One of the things that Vinge was saying was kind of a criticism. He was saying, you know, maybe super intelligent machines could fuse with elite individuals and become essentially god kings. And you know, people like Ray Kurzweil were like, yeah, you're talking about me, let's do that as soon as possible. Even though Vinge was saying, yeah, that's not going to happen. So I think that what I learned was the reality out of NASA was we have very talented people working on hard problems like air traffic control. We need to augment them. And we don't need to be making billionaires into god kings.
No, let's not do that. I feel like they just not. You know, I'm not trying to see altered carbon come real, you know, come true, right? That's
right. Yeah, I know.
You know, that's the hard pass. that's not good. And so one thing when we were talking originally, you know, you brought up the Macy conferences and how they framed intelligence as a property of systems, not of individuals. How do you think that concept shows up in today's multi-agent or co-pilot architectures?
I mean, it certainly does. And I think you've really nailed it there. So the Macy conferences were late 40s going into the 60s. Basically, people working on really complex systems got together. So, you know, people building nuclear weapons were like, hey, we have some hard problems. We're trying to grapple with it. But people working with complex social systems were also like, you know, we've got that problem too. And so they all got together. And a lot of the early people in neural networks were involved. And then there's this notion of second order cybernetics that came out really where you really take into account the people in the system. So going back to my model before, where you have teams of people and machines collaborating, what are the feedback loops? Where are the OODA loops there? There was something that came out of it called autopoiesis, which is a formal description of cognition. And I love this one through line. There was a grad student back in the, I think it was early 50s, but the original neural network, artificial neural network team was called McCullough and Pitts, and they were at MIT. And when they published one of their seminal papers, it's called What the Frog's Eye Tells the Frog's Brain. One of the authors was this grad student, Alberto Maturana. And then, you know, later on, he was involved in Project CyberSyn, which is a great footnote, but really kind of amazing. First time of like data science being used in government. And then Maturana was later, he came up with Francisco Varela, this notion of autopoiesis, essentially control systems that involve people and cognition as well as machines. I think would be a good way to describe it. And there have been a lot of other people that, like Günther Teubner's work on autopoiesis in law with rhetorical oscillators is just fascinating. Nicholas Luhmann talking about social systems, et cetera. So a lot of this becomes kind of blueprint for what we're really seeing roll out as far as on the ground, practical, rolling out AI applications into your workflows, into your organizations, particularly in an enterprise context. I think rolling back to like Macy's conference, a lot of that really established a lot of what we're executing now on as blueprint. And I think that if you look at like a diagram describing reinforcement learning, again, going back to optimal control theory from the 50s, what autopilots are based on, if you take an optimal control theory loop, we've got some, you know, marginal range of the control parameters. And if you get outside the range, here's policy for how to bring it back. It's not based on models, it's based on policies. So reinforcement learning is basically taking that and adding deep learning as like this really extensive memory store, AI memory store, if you want to think about it, about learning policy, what policies work, what don't work. And the way it's trained, you can think of like portfolio management. I don't just go out and bet on one stock and hope that, you know, 40 years later, it's gone through the roof. I build a portfolio and I see what's working, what's not working, and I adjust the quantities in the portfolio. That's how reinforcement learning is trained. But there's an environment and there are agents and there are risks and there are rewards and there's feedback. And when you look at how reinforcement learning works, where the agents are in that vis-a-vis their environment, this goes back to, again, the teams of people and machines. How are they working together? Where are you seeing those risks and rewards? We talk about an explore-exploit trade-off. So you want to invest some of your time into exploring, hey, what are some better things we could be doing? Where are there more opportunities? What are the areas of unknowns that actually can give us upside? Versus, hey, I've learned this now. Let me actually extract. Let me get some value out of it. So working on these feedback loops is really how you bring systems of AI that incorporate the people. And you know, realistically, these kind of mechanisms are being used. If you look at tools like DSPy, I very much recommend, it's got this kind of optimization loop. So with DSPy, for instance, if you're building an agent to do a specific task, you do not write a prompt. Don't even bother with that. Instead, you write a function that's going to solve. And in the doc string for the function, you know, in the documentation of your procedure, basically, you say, here are my inputs. These are the types. And then here's what the expected output will look like when you're done. And the system will synthesize a prompt for the LLM to use. But then when you're running, you use evaluations to figure out, hey, how well did I do? And if I didn't do very well, let's log all those evaluations. And then later go back and data mine those logs and have this feedback loop to optimize how you generate the prompt. So DSPy is really fantastic. It's a project out of Stanford for doing context engineering. Seriously, you can build most of the stuff that's being hawked as like entire companies. You can probably rewrite most of those companies in about 10 lines of Python.
That's
crazy. But the cool thing is the feedback loop. And where do the people sit in that feedback loop?
Absolutely. And yeah, I mean, you mentioned, you know, I mean, we're talking about humans, you know, human scale AI interfaces. What are some of the products out there that violate those, that violate?
I'm most of social media is an extreme violation. I mean, anything that I feel that like you want to talk about social networks, it's like, you know, if you're giving me an infinite feed and, you know, I just have to basically stare at my phone for 5 hours before I can consume it. It's not actually social. I mean, you're interacting with an app, but you're not actually interacting with people. So I think that those are the kind of concerns. You know, people have attention spans, right? It's like 18 minutes is a TED talk because that's a human attention span. People can only work a shift so long before they start making mistakes. And of course, you know, in the military and in industry, of course, we see this a lot. There's reasons why you don't want to overwork people on a critical line. You know, taking these factors into scale, what can people perceive? How fast can they perceive it? How long, how much can they get hammered with new information? All of these kind of facts. I mean, industrial design has been collecting a lot of ground truth about this for, you know, the past century. And these are the things we need to use. Whereas I think Silicon Valley is more like, no, we need to add more features because of our OKR evaluations at the end of the quarter. I mean, if you ever looked at like early Amazon, the design of early Amazon, the front page was like entirely done automatically, and it was impossible to understand. And I mean, I think that's the learning is like, we do know how to build things. You know, how do we build aircraft, fighter aircraft cockpits so that the people under stress can operate when they need to? We know that like a Mercedes-Benz is a very comfortable ride because a comfortable driver is a safer driver. You know, these things are known well. They're just not practiced as much in AI, but they're also like a big opportunity for AI, I think.
I completely agree with you. You know, and you know, so knowledge graphs, they're, you know, are usually like serve as like the memory of organizations. How do you see them evolving into genuine participants in team cognition?
Yeah, no, that's excellent. So I work a lot in that space, knowledge graphs. And definitely you can think of how, you know, a graph can be used to express entities, relations, properties, but really express a lot of learnings, or rather pointers to, and by the way, here's like the five documents that really nail this issue. So they're really good for collecting that, also navigating it, manipulating it to use to present to LLMs to make decisions, as we do in GraphWriting. I think the way that this plays out is if you roll the clock back about 5 years, I was in a really interesting conversation. The guy who created Rome Research, you know, the note-taking outlining product that's very popular, he came into a graph conference and we were talking with some AI practitioners about it. And the idea was like the outlining tools, like you'll see in Notion or Rome, you know, those are graphs. And we actually have APIs and we started playing with like, let's bring this into a graph and run some algorithms, run some AI apps downstream, and kind of connected the dots and said, wow, we've got people collaborating on like outlining and putting down ideas, you know, into these collaborative tools. But these collaborative tools actually fit the AI tools. The thing that's in between them is a graph. And so that's where we are seeing graphs being used for like agentic memory, rolling back to blackboard systems from, again, from the 70s. This is where you have to really understand what's the difference between like episodic memory versus short-term memory versus long-term memory. Like, how do you really break down the categories of how memory is being used? But once you do, you can find some stuff's kind of ephemeral. You don't want it to clog up the memory because it's good for a transaction, but you don't want to keep it around for 5 years. Other stuff is just really kind of distilled. And so how can we take something that's a graph? How can we see repeat patterns in a graph and distill them into higher level concepts? There's a lot of great work for that that gets into some really interesting math and physics. If you want to look at like manifold theory or look at, there's a great project called Aerospace, arrow as in the word, you know, pulling an arrow, archery, and space. It's a callback to Kenneth Arrow. But basically, you can take a hard problem in graphs and you can run Rayleigh energy and get a spectral distribution. The way I would put it is like, have you ever used Shazam, the music app? Like you're listening to a song, you might know what it
Yeah, of
is.
course.
But, okay, that was Avery Wang was the tech co-founder. We went to school together. Basically, they're sampling and then they run an FFT and they get a spectrum, right? And they're like, okay, cool. You can do spectral indexing. You can do searches on music really fast. It's completely different than say like Spotify is going to recommend something to you. They have a very different mechanism. So think about that. If you're doing embedding models right now, a lot in AI is using embedding models. You know, finding the nearest neighbors for any vector, kind of a brute force. If instead you can take a spectral analysis of all those neighborhoods, then you can be doing much smarter, much faster comparisons. I can take and sample from a laser, for milliseconds and get a spectral distribution. I can sample it for 5 hours. It's not going to change, hopefully. So spectral indexing is a really interesting area here where I think that there's a lot of lift in some of these applications to make the AI mechanisms just so much smarter.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Sorry if I'm getting out in the weeds.
No, man. Listen, I'm fascinated. I'm just like processing it as you're saying it. As I said, I'm not as technical as you are by any stretch of the imagination, and I find it absolutely fascinating, Paco. So, yeah, and one of the things that we are seeing is like as a problem within government now is that people are spending less time in government careers, right? How can we use and that. Unfortunately, that means that the institutional memory of organizations are not as long. How do you think we could use AI to, help preserve some of that institutional knowledge?
Absolutely. I mean, we've got some great examples for that. It's a extremely good question. I'm going out to AI conferences. I'm talking with leading stakeholders, and they pull you aside and they tell you what's keeping them up at night. And it's about the fact that the people who know how to actually run the business are retiring, and the frontline people, the tenure has dropped. So I was talking to an intelligence unit in a different country, and they had people who frontline investigators might have 10 years in the role. It's dropped to 3 years. And trying to get new people to come into the job, there's a 2-year period of training. So you might get 1 year out of them useful. And so to address this, yeah, the institutional knowledge, it's disappearing. How do we bring new people in and really get them up to speed? Because if you take your senior most people and cannibalize their operations, actually pull them off the line to train the new people, realistically, the new people are going to forget half of what's said like the next week. So that
Absolutely.
doesn't work. You're upside down. I will shout out to my friend Sebastian Kukla. He's at RHI Magnesita, a large steel firm in Pittsburgh. He was one of the execs. They pulled him and said, "Hey, look, you're the new AI exec, or fix your resume." So Sebastian hit the ground running, and what they realized was like, they're a steel firm. They have this $1 billion a year liability in terms of invoicing being done incorrectly. But their invoicing is being done by new hires, by frontline people. But like in steel, I mean, there's a lot of tariff concerns, tax, shipping, all this stuff. You get that wrong, you're going to have to redo it, renegotiate. You've lost a lot of money. And so that was the first thing they tackled was how can we have co-pilots working with our really experienced people so that when a new hire is working on an invoice and they're starting to make a mistake again, say, "Hey, look, something's weird here. You should talk to your boss, like get this confirmed because something's not right." And people learn from that. And so this is a way to take and have some of the agents kind of intermediating between that sort of mentorship of the institutional knowledge transfer. And I mean, a shout out to Sebastian. They got that project up and running in about 6 months. They came back the next year at this conference and reported on it. He's done, I can link, but he's done some really fantastic talks about it. And I see this being so important in government. But the other thing too is just mission. I mean, I was in a room with a bunch of candidates who were trying to be recruited for a certain mission, and they were worried. The powers that be were worried that like Meta was throwing a lot of enormous salaries at these same people. But when you talk to the grad students, they're like, I'd rather go tell my friends what I did to interdict human trafficking. That's a much better bragging point than like some ridiculous feature at Facebook. So it's like you have to get back to like really what's motivating people. And I think that that's a lot of the answer too.
Yeah, no, I completely agree. I completely agree with you, and I've heard similar things from folks in our government that like they have tr they're ha they're having trouble retaining folks because, like they, Silicon Valley or big tech is throwing ridiculous pay packages at them, and how many times do they need to pay? How many times do they need to X your salary before it's like, I don't know, is it like 5X, 10X? Because they can do all of that, right? If they want you bad enough. But it's fascinating, man. So I have one more question for you, Paco. One last question. If you could rewrite AI policy around the idea of team intelligence instead of artificial intelligence, what practical changes would you make in procurement evaluation or ethics?
Excellent question. And the thing about this, again, I would really get like legal and HR as coaches. Front and center, not as like the bad guys who are going to end your career, but like come in, address the people problems, address the ethical problems, address the issues of rhetoric, because that's the stumbling block when you've got a bunch of people and they're working across different teams or different camps, they're arguing about things. I again, I'd mentioned a few texts that I think that really speak to it, but like Seeing Like a State is a really great text for like why measurements done wrong are a disaster. And you can look at the origins of statistics in like the emergence of the German state and how they destroyed their forest industry by measuring it too closely. So that's one book. The other one I mentioned was like Grammar of Motives, Kenneth Burke's Contemporary Rhetoric, understanding really breaking down critiques of what people are discussing when they're discussing. Again, a lot of what you're seeing is you really understand a person and the relationship by the rhetoric. And the other one I was mentioning was like, Open Society and Its Enemies, Popper's seminal work, but the notion there of like falsifiability and really validating what is being argued, what is being discussed. I think that a lot of these kinds of concerns are where we can really leverage the reasoning and the inference capabilities of machines, maybe not LLM reasoning, but there's a lot of other reasoning. But we have to understand how do we reason? And unfortunately, the people in the mix aren't really there. I mean, the people who really understand about reasoning, frankly, are the judiciary. This is what they do all day, every day. And they talk about all kinds of crazy reasoning theories and they apply it in verdicts. Most people, most mere mortals, never even know that those forms of reasoning exist. I went and did a catalog of that at one point, just to try to see. So I think that we're really just only scratching the surface of how we can bring machines in and really augment how people work together, especially when it comes to doing something hard in a smart way. But it's not going to be because there's 5,000 features on OpenAI. It's going to be because you've brought in this interdisciplinary insights from people like experience with the judiciary, experience with coaching teams, these kinds of things.
Absolutely. No, interdisciplinary team is fascinating. There was a book that I read last year, called God, what's it called? I'm blanking on the name, but Range by David Epstein. It's a I don't know if you read this
Interesting.
book or not, or if you know it. It's subtitled is Why Generalists Thrive in a Highly Specialized World, right?
Yeah, I have heard
And
of that. Yeah.
so there was a gentleman, and I'm blanking on his name too, who went and he had a research project where he was going across, he was going to all these different research laboratories and trying to figure out why some labs were more productive than others, right? And what he found was that the labs that did very diverse kinds of research, and then had meetings where they brought people like had pro like where, say you're a physicist and you go in, you can present a problem you're having difficulties with to like a team of biologists and all, people doing all kinds of different research. Those are the labs that were far faster at solving problems and were more productive than the ones that were, say, all physicists, because they're going to have the same gaps, the same assumptions. They're going to reinforce each other in a way that, and they're not going to challenge each other on basic fundamentals that, say, like a biologist would. So I'm big on the interdisciplinary thing, interdisciplinary approach to teams and problem solving. So love it, man.
Most of them.
Everybody, thank you for listening to Robots and Red Tape today.